You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a new geology app from UW researchers aims to help us understand the earth beneath our feet. We'll meet the creators of Rocked.
First, this month's Marquette Law School poll came out today. The poll gathered data on where Wisconsinites stand on the presidential candidates, the Senate race, and more. With a really eventful week for both presidential candidates of the major parties, the survey shows major shifts in opinions around Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Charles Franklin joins us now. He's the director of the Marquette Law School poll and professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I guess the top question on everybody's mind is, how big an impact did the Trump tapes and also maybe the debate, but I think your polling happened before that, but how big a debate and impact did this have, the Trump tapes?
Right. We did finish our interviews before the Sunday night debate, so it had nothing to do with our results. We saw, first of all, overall, a shift from a 3-point Clinton lead 3 weeks ago to a 7-point Clinton lead today. But we saw rapid and large shifts over the weekend as the Trump videotape story was released on Friday afternoon at about 3 o'clock our time. And we saw that move through the survey for overall a shift of about 20 points in Clinton's direction between Thursday before the videotape was story broke and the combination of interviews done on Saturday and Sunday afterwards. In our Saturday and Sunday data, Clinton holds a 19-point lead. Now, it's important to stress that this is the short-term impact of that story. We don't know at this point from our data whether the debate shifted that at all, or whether this short-term impact will prove fleeting, or whether it'll be enduring. Only time will answer that. But I do think we have pretty strong evidence that, at least in the short term, there was quite a movement away from Trump and towards Clinton. That's also about the same impact, somewhere in the teens or low 20s, when we look at men and women, and when we look at people who consider themselves evangelicals, and also non-college whites and college-educated whites. All of those moved to somewhat different degrees, but between 10 and 20, or as much as 24 points in a Clinton direction.
And let's break it down, as you said, a little bit more and take a look at what happened with women and evangelicals. What did you see there?
Yeah. Well, with women, one of Clinton's strong points, on Thursday she led by 9 points among the women we interviewed. But by Saturday and Sunday, that lead was 33 points. Among evangelicals, which is a strong Trump group, Trump led by 40 points on Thursday, but that shrunk to 16 points for Trump, still leading, by Saturday and Sunday. So that's a fall off of 24 points between Thursday and Saturday and Sunday.
And so looking now, you know, more broadly at attitudes surrounding the two presidential candidates from the major parties, what did you see there?
We ask about traits these candidates have. Would you describe them as honest, cares about you, qualified for the office? The one that both of them do poorly on is honesty. Only 29% say Clinton is honest. Only 32% say that. I'm sorry, 33% say that of Trump. And that's been pretty consistent in the high 20s, low 30s for both of them. But typically, as with this one, a little bit more, a little bit higher percentage saying Trump is honest than for Clinton, a 4-point difference this time. On cares about people like you, Clinton does a bit better. 47% say she does care about people like you. 50% say she does not. But for Trump, it's only 35% cares, 61% does not. And then finally, the strongest area for Clinton is qualified for the office. 58% say she is qualified, 40% say she's not. But for Trump, it's 33% qualified and 65% not. Those have moved a little bit over the course of the campaign, but none of them have moved really substantially. Finally, we did ask for the first time this time, would you say the candidate shows good judgment? 48% say Clinton does, 50% say she does not. But for Trump, it's 28% good judgment, 70% does not. So you see there the gamut of traits where there's a slight Trump advantage on honesty to where there's a very substantial Clinton advantage on qualifications for the office.
Some of these numbers seem pretty striking. For instance, that Clinton, 29% of people, only 29% would deem her trustworthy, but she's leading in the state of Wisconsin. Have you seen numbers like this before?
Well, we see a couple of things. One is partly these numbers reflect the fact that within the party, voters are considerably more favorable to the candidates, both for Clinton among Democrats and for Trump among Republicans. It's the other party that has really extremely negative views of both of these candidates, and that pulls them down overall. So the differences that we see between honesty and cares and qualified and good judgment, those are more revealing because those differences are showing up despite the fact that the other party thinks fairly poorly of the candidates.
Charles Franklin is with us right now. He's a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll, and we're getting the results of the latest law school poll right now. And let's turn now to the Senate race between Ron Johnson, the incumbent, and Russ Feingold. What did you see this time?
Well, here we see a tightening of the race. As the presidential race moved in a Democratic direction, the Senate race has tightened a little bit. 3 weeks ago, Feingold had a 5-point lead over Ron Johnson, and that's a 2-point lead now inside the margin of error. 6 weeks ago, it was a 3-point Feingold lead. So recently, we've seen a 3-point, a 5-point, and now a 2-point race. I think at the very least, it's fair to say this is a low single digits race at this point, and it's quite close. But with a Feingold advantage, if a small one. However, looking over the last 3 weeks, we do see some movement that has benefited Ron Johnson, and in part this matches up with some of his recent advertising. On cares about people like you, for example, Johnson has gone from 37% saying that to 45%, a gain of 8 points. Over the last 3 weeks. Feingold over the same period went from 50 to 52. So Feingold is still a little bit better seen, 52 to 45 on caring, but Johnson has made some real movement, some real progress on that measure over these 3 weeks. On honesty, we see them both about equal. 52% say Feingold is honest, 49% say that of Ron Johnson. And finally, on favorability, we see some closing of the gap between them there. Over this 3 weeks, Feingold has actually dipped down by 3 points on favorable from 48 to 45, while Johnson has risen by 8 points from 35 to 43. So they are now at close to parity on favorability and close to parity on honesty. And Johnson has made positive moves on both the favorability and on the cares measure.
Now, you did the presidential polling on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You got to see the effect of the Trump tapes, although not the debate. When did you poll about Feingold and Johnson, wondering about, for instance, Ron Johnson's decision to stick by Donald Trump?
Yeah, we polled all of them over the same days, Thursday through Sunday. And so the sample is identical for the presidential and for the Senate race. Whereas it's fairly obvious what the major news about Donald Trump was over the weekend, I think news about the Senate race surely was a good deal less visible over that period. I think we'll have to wait a while to see if the presidential race plays a role in these other races, both the Senate and perhaps down ballot races, that's clearly still a developing story as Donald Trump has had some arguments with Paul Ryan this week and John McCain. And the relationship between Trump and the party, I think, is still very much in a state of flux. The one thing we do know from our data is that both Johnson and Feingold have won the backing of their parties. Johnson is getting 89% of the Republican vote, and Feingold is getting 90% of the Democratic vote. In contrast, Donald Trump is getting 78% of the Republican vote, while Clinton gets 90% of the Democratic vote. So Trump has been a bit less successful at uniting the party behind him, whereas in the Senate race we're seeing a fairly typical polarized and partisan contest, with independents leaning a little bit to Feingold.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Charles Franklin. He is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. We just heard the latest results. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new Wisconsin-made app aims to boost our knowledge of the ground we're standing on. We'll meet the creators of Rocked.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
President Theodore Roosevelt was on his way to a campaign rally in Milwaukee when he was shot at close range by a would-be assassin. Dean Robbins tells us what happened on that October day.
Memphis is linked to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and Dallas to that of John F. Kennedy. Milwaukee might have become similarly notorious if it weren't for a pair of spectacles and a thick sheaf of paper. In 1912, Theodore Roosevelt ran for another term as President of the United States on a third-party ticket. The colorful politician had declared himself as fit as a bull moose when he entered the race, so his new party became known as the Bull Moose Party. Supporters greeted him with moose calls, and women's colleges formed moosette leagues. Among his campaign songs was, "Oh, You Beautiful Moose." The Bull Moose theme reflected Roosevelt's indomitable spirit, not to mention his playfulness. His campaign itself, however, was as serious as could be.
Friends, our task as Americans is to strive for social and industrial justice achieved through the genuine rule of the people.
Roosevelt passionately supported desegregation, women's suffrage, and other radical ideas for the time. This made him a lot of enemies, and assassination threats dogged him on the trail. At one campaign stop, Roosevelt fended off an attacker using jiu-jitsu moves. Then came Milwaukee on October 14th. On the way to his speech, Roosevelt left the Hotel Gilpatrick for his car. As he waved to the crowd, a man named John Schrank shot him in the chest. The bullet might have killed the ex-president had it not been slowed by his metal spectacles case and folded 50-page speech. Nevertheless, it lodged in his rib, and he bled profusely. A normal man would have gone straight to the hospital, but this was no man. This was a bull moose. Roosevelt insisted on proceeding to Milwaukee Auditorium for his speech. Audience members were aghast when a pale, unsteady Theodore Roosevelt took to the stage. He showed them his bloody shirt and held up the bullet-scarred pages of his speech. "Friends," he said, "I shall ask you to be as quiet as possible. I don't know whether you fully understand that I have just been shot." Amazingly, Roosevelt continued for 90 minutes, delivering his full speech. Only then did he allow aides to rush him to the hospital. Schrank, the would-be assassin, was shipped to the Central State Mental Hospital in Waupun, never to return. The Hotel Gilpatrick erected a plaque to mark the spot where Roosevelt survived the attack, and it remains in the Hyatt Regency that took the Gilpatrick's place on Kilbourne Avenue. Theodore Roosevelt received more votes in the 1912 election than any third-party candidate in history, but still lost to Woodrow Wilson. One thing he didn't lose was the bullet. It stayed in his chest for the rest of his life, though he paid it little mind. the Milwaukee shooting barely slowed down this bull moose on his trot to Mount Rushmore.
Dean Robbins is a writer and children's book author in Madison. His most recent book is Miss Paul and the President. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, a new app developed here in Wisconsin aims to help people understand the geology of the world around them in their own backyards and as they travel around the state and beyond.
Yeah, and if you're like me, this could be really useful. I'm interested in rocks and landscapes, and I'm generally pretty clueless about what's going on around me. Shannon Peters and John Chaplesky join us now in the studio. Shannon is a professor of geoscience at UW-Madison. John is a programmer analyst in the geoscience department. They are the creators of the free app Rockd. That's R-O-C-K-D. Shannon, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's fun to be here.
And John, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Shannon, what was the inspiration for this app, first of all?
Well, so I spent a lot of time in the field with students, and I spent a fair bit of time trying to figure out where to go to see rocks that tell us about the world's past and future, perhaps. And there's a lot of time involved in that, and it's never sure what you're going to find when you get there because things change. Road cuts are formed this year, and 10 years from now, they're going to look quite a bit different. So there's a sort of a practical goal. The practical goal is, where can we go find evidence of the past history of Earth and see it and look at it in our hands? So that's step one. And then step two is to sort of fulfill this goal all geologists have, and that is to see a lot of rocks. And there's this old adage that's been repeated for a long time that says the best geologist is the one who's seen the most rocks. And it's tongue-in-cheek, but there's some truth to it. The more experience you have, the more likely you are to see something familiar when you see a new rock. So this app gives us a chance to sort of track that.
And John, we're holding our phone in our hand. The app Rockd is up. What do we do with it? What do we actually do?
So there's a couple things you can do with it. Step one is you can just see what kinds of rocks you're standing on. It's the first screen you see when you pull it up, and it'll tell you the age and the names of the rocks that you're standing on. Additionally, there's a map interface that you can go to learn more about the rocks that you're standing on or that might be nearby, including links to primary literature associated with those links. That comes from GeoDeepDive, another project that we work on. You can also see other observations from other users of the app as well, to see what things they've seen nearby, what observations they've made about them. And then you can also post your own observations about rocks that you're currently looking at.
And Shannon, what's the scope here? Is this Wisconsin, national, worldwide?
Well, of course, we have very good maps for right here in Dane County and in Wisconsin, but it is worldwide in coverage. One of the cool things about the application is that it takes advantage of a very large body of work that's been produced by hundreds of geoscientists working for decades, many decades, to produce a body of knowledge that we tap into. And one of the cool things about the app is that you're tapping into, in a pretty seamless way, actually over 70 different geological maps from many different sources in one sort of integrated environment. So the answer is we have global coverage, but the detail of the coverage varies from place to place.
And John, what state is Rockd in right now, development-wise?
It just came out a couple weeks ago on iOS. We're working hard to have an Android version come out soon. But right now I'd say that we're kind of at the point where we have minimal functionality that's worthwhile. So we have lots of good features in store yet.
Okay, and people can help you beta it, right, if they download it and tell you what works and what doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. So anytime you download it, if you have any positive or negative feedback about it, we always love to hear about it.
And Shannon, speaking of feedback, is there a citizen science element to this where you as a geologist, a geoscientist, are hoping to learn from, you know, us ordinary folks?
Absolutely. So I got my start as a citizen scientist,
really?
As it were. My uncle is an amateur fossil collector back in Ohio where I grew up, and that's how I fell in love with the field from a very young age. And I'm a firm believer in the ability of people with the willingness and time to go out and look at nature, I can learn from them as a professional geoscientist. And this application gives you a powerful tool because it's geolocation aware, so it knows where you are. And we add to some of that location awareness geological information that we know about. And even if you're not exactly sure, you still have the ability to take a picture with a geolocation, upload it, and perhaps make some guesses as to what it is. But with the visual evidence that this is the photo, we can go further, and maybe then we can go there ourselves and check it out if it looks interesting.
Now, a maybe this is a non-relevant question, but I love being on the shores of, say, Lake Superior and looking at the rocks that have been washed, and I don't have a clue what rock is what. Is there an element of the app that's going to help me either identify that or send it to somebody else and they can help me out?
In the future, I think that's something we'll aim for. Right now, what we're focused on are the rocks that haven't moved around. So okay. Wisconsin is interesting in that it has pieces of Canada, basically, that have been dropped all over it from the last glacial advances and retreats. And so this app is more focused on what hasn't moved around. However, in the future, we anticipate some of the elements that are in the application allow you to tag rocks, like this is granite, this is limestone, and so forth, will become more of a guide to help you recognize them, too.
And, John, I understand you work on political mapping sometimes. Was there a unique challenge to geological mapping?
I think the biggest challenge with geologic mapping is that the maps occur at so many different scales, right? So you have maps of the whole world, and then you have maps all the way down to Dane County. And coming up with clever ways to blend the best information available at a given place was definitely a challenge.
And Shannon, as we wrap up, what kind of response are you getting? I know we're just a couple weeks in on a beta release, but are you getting good response from citizen scientists and your colleagues in the field?
Yeah, I'm honestly, I wasn't sure what to expect, but the response has been good in the form that, you know, we have over 700 registered users now, people that have logged in, and some of them are actually contributing new observations daily.
Well, Shannon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
And John, thanks for coming up.
Thanks for having us.
We've been talking to Shannon Peters, professor of geoscience at UW-Madison, and John Chaplesky, programmer analyst at the UW-Madison Department of Geoscience. They are the creators of the new geology app, ROCKD, that's spelled R-O-C-K-D.
Coming up, we'll talk with a police sergeant from Darlington who's been recognized for his work building trust between police and the communities they serve. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's storytelling on Snap Judgment. Tonight's theme, you can sound human, you can look human, but what happens when you take a hard look inside and realize you're missing something? That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, as police departments around the country and in Wisconsin grapple with the challenge of building trust between officers and the communities they serve, particularly minority communities, some law enforcement officials are turning to the city of Darlington in southwestern Wisconsin.
Sergeant Tony Rezga recently spoke at the 21st Century Policing Conference at UW-Platteville about the unique efforts he took to build trust and understanding in the city of Darlington. When a company called Mexican Cheese Producers came to Darlington about 15 years ago, a substantial influx of new Latino residents followed.
As the community faced new struggles centered around race and culture, Rezga instituted an open-door policy for Latinos. He helped foster community events, helped arrange oil changes for Spanish speakers, and started a Latino basketball team. Rezga says building a relationship of trust is ongoing, but it's one that can pay off when it comes to fighting and solving crime.
Sergeant Tony Rezga joins us now. He's a 16-year veteran of the Darlington Police Department. In 2010, he received the Police Officer of the Year Award from the 3rd District of the American Legion for his work in the community with the growing Hispanic population in Darlington and southwestern Wisconsin. Sergeant Rezga, welcome to Central Time.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, when Mexican cheese producers came to town 15 years ago to Darlington, what changed?
Well, we started seeing a great influx of Hispanics coming to our area for opportunities for work, not only at Mexican cheese, but also within the dairy farms. And so we started seeing a lot of migration into the city.
And at that time, what kinds of struggles were you seeing as the residents who had already been there, I'm assuming presumably white residents, and the new Hispanic residents came together?
Well, there was definitely conflicts. I mean, it and none of that has completely ended, and I don't think that anybody could safely ever say that it will completely end. But what we were seeing is we were seeing conflicts between the cultures, and that is kind of what drove me to step in and hope to help curb some of those conflicts and bridge some of those gaps.
And tell us a little bit about what you did at that point. You didn't have necessarily any training for this sort of situation, but you did try some things that were new. What did you do?
Yeah, well, actual training, but I did grow up in an immigrant family. My father was a immigrant from Mexico, and so I got to see firsthand the struggles that my father faced and our family faced through the different systems that were in place. So when I was here, being here in Darlington gave me a unique opportunity to help serve that community that was moving in quite at a rapid pace, and then serve the community that was already here. So some of the, things that I started popping in my head was just to get Hispanics involved in the community so they could be more part of the community and in fact claim ownership in their community. So some of the things that I did, the initial things, like people talk about the basketball team that I formed, well, that was simply to curb some issues that I was seeing in the bars with bar fights and things like that. There was a league, a city league, and some of the bars that members attended those city leagues. So forming the basketball team was just a way to get people to meet the Hispanics, and that in return kind of helped curb some of those tensions in the bars, some of those racial tensions. And after I saw that there was some positive there, I thought, well, I think I'm onto something here.
I'm really curious about what that was like in the beginning, especially with this basketball team. You told me a little bit of this earlier when we spoke, and it sounds like the guys from the bars who were not used to seeing Hispanics in their bars became, they started to accept the Latinos who were there to play, and something new transpired between them. What were those first games like?
Yeah, well, the first games obviously were kind of new because Hispanics traditionally don't, perform, play basketball. I mean, there is basketball in Latin American countries and things like that, but the reality is that it's not a top sport. So getting the Hispanics convinced to participate was a chore. But I think that those original people actually saw it as an advantage to the bigger picture. And I don't think we ever won a game. It wasn't for that. I participated myself so they could see that I could be part of that group and kind of mesh that bridge, kind of build that bridge between the two. And then what I started to see was more of the Caucasians become friends with these people and with Hispanics and with whatever other ethnicity started joining us. Because there are different cultures that we've experienced just here in Darlington. We've had people from Peru, we've had people from Honduras, we have people from Mexico, which all have different cultures and all have different customs. And that kind of just started meshing together, and it slowly but surely solved that some of those issues, those tensions in the bars.
We're talking right now with Sergeant Tony Rezga. He's a 16-year veteran of the Darlington Police Department in southwestern Wisconsin, and he's been speaking lately about what he helped to do in Darlington, which is forming this positive relationship between police and, at the time, Hispanic community, Latino community, adding more people to that umbrella over the years in Darlington there. And you mentioned that your father was an immigrant. He'd been deported several times when you were younger. How did that experience inform your approach in Darlington?
It was very difficult for us when I was a child. My father was actually deported 39 times. We used to live in Texas, so it was a lot different than up here in Wisconsin, and the times were different. In the 70s, it was just different times. So the very difficult times, every time he was deported, and he was our primary source of income. So waiting, and hoping that he'd be able to come back and those kind of things. My mother is an American citizen, and obviously we were, but we were a family of five, and we depended on on his ability to work and support us. So those times are very difficult. So I got to see firsthand the system at play and what that did to families.
Did you ever get pushback within your own ranks, the police ranks, for maybe going outside the box with this? I mean, I know, for instance, one of the things you did was you brought in a lawyer to talk to the Hispanic community about immigration issues. Did anyone ever say, you know what, this is too much?
No. Actually, that's probably been the main help that has contributed to the success, I guess, in Darlington, is we have not gotten back blow from, especially from our department. The good thing is that we've had a strong leadership throughout, and I think they recognized that, you know, barring people's personal emotions and personal feelings towards immigration and those things, we have a fundamental right to serve all people within our city and within our country. And I think that's where we strive. And I think that's what's helped us here in Darlington be successful. So, no, I didn't get much back blow that way. I also, you know, was given some freedoms, especially as I began to take on this role. Initially, you know, I was a night officer, so I didn't have a lot of recourse. But as I began to promote throughout the department and become a supervisor and having a younger supervisor myself, we were able to be forward thinkers and think a little bit ahead of times and be proactive with the population and the people in general.
Now, I know that you've been approached sometimes by other police forces who say, I want what you have there in Darlington. What's the secret recipe? What do you tell them?
Well, and that, especially now, it seems that within the last month or so, I've really been receiving a lot of attention because of the conference at UW-Platteville. But the reality is that there is no secret recipe. I've gone to several communities to speak where they've, you know, have some issues. And the main issue, I would say, is trust. And I honestly believe that just like Chief Noble Ray stated at the conference, that trust is a journey that there's never an end to. You really can never get to the end of that. You can never actually reach that journey. And the reality is that's the truth. It's a very cumbersome thing, and trust is, I gain trust the same way I lose trust. One day you're helping someone, and the next day you may have to effect an arrest on a family member, and all of a sudden you've lost everybody that you've built trust with for months or even years. The key is being fair, being consistent, keeping your ducks in a row, and being honest with people, even though that honesty may not be what they wanted to hear.
We're talking right now with Sergeant Tony Rezga. He's a 16-year veteran of the Darlington Police Department in southwestern Wisconsin, and he's credited with helping to build a positive relationship between police and the Hispanic community over the years in Darlington.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're from the Darlington area, have you seen this in action? How has it influenced the community there? And for people around the state, have you seen similar efforts to build bridges between the locals and the new immigrant community, whether that's from Latin America, Southeast Asia, or wherever in the world? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Police Sergeant Tony Rezga is with us now. He's a 16-year veteran with the Darlington Police Department. That's in southwestern Wisconsin. And he's joining us to talk about his work building trust between the police force and the community it serves.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you yourself are from Darlington or that area, have you seen this approach at work? How have things changed for better? What could still be done? And for people anywhere in the state, what do you see happening for better or worse, building police community relationships, especially with minority communities? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Sergeant Rezga, you've said that you're always preparing for the day that a police-involved shooting happens. So how do you prepare for something like that?
Well, I don't think you can prepare actually for the event, but what I prepare for is this community support. I think that's key. I pray to God that never occurs here, but the reality is that, you know, some situations require fast acting decisions and quick thought and relying on training and those kind of things. But when it's all said and done, I mean, it's never easy on any side when somebody has to take someone's life or injure someone or anything like that, especially if you're a police officer who, you know, goes to work to do a job. And that's one of the things with police is we are here to do a job, a function in the community. And so that's a big responsibility. And I mean, there is, obviously on the other side, I mean, you're having to deal with family members and community leaders and those kind of things. So I think strengthening your relationship with your community can prepare you for those things, how to better serve that community in case something like this happens, so you can hear the other side. And since you've had a strong working relationship with them, there won't be a lot of blame game going on. There will be more of how can we make sure this doesn't happen again. We've done this, but we can do this and we can do that. And so that's kind of where I say I prepare. And we're very proactive here, trying to build a relationship, a positive relationship. Like I said, building trust is not that easy. You know, like you said earlier, talking to communities that basically call me and want some kind of outline on how to go about doing that. It isn't written anywhere. And the reality is what works in one community may not work in another. But what has worked for us is patience and determination and passion. I have a passion to serve the people, and I have a patience to serve the people. And my whole goal is to serve. So I work in many facets, not only the police department, as a service-based individual. You got to find those individuals to help build that relationship and trust within the community. Like I said, you could find people within the community that do not like me and probably do not trust me. I'm still working on those people. And the thoughts are to always be working toward building that trust and being open-minded about it and being able to accept that maybe some of the things that you've tried didn't work and now you've got to change it, but actually listening to the community.
Do you have any advice for police departments that are struggling with this? I'm thinking of some of the tensions that boiled over in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood, and not just there, but around the country. I know you say it's individual and it takes passion, but are there any specific things that someone could do if they wanted to get going on this right now?
I think finding the person that is passionate about it, and not, it doesn't necessarily need to be someone. I mean, I've been asked, you know, do we need to hire a Hispanic officer? Do we need to hire, you know, somebody who speaks Spanish or someone? No, I don't think that that's the answer. I don't think you necessarily need to have a Hispanic officer patrolling Hispanic people. I don't know if that, I mean, to me, that doesn't make the most sense because there aren't a whole lot of Hispanic officers. In Southwest Wisconsin, I don't think there's any but myself. But so I don't think that that's the solution. I honestly think that the solution is to find someone who's passionate to be involved and who truly understands community-oriented policing, which means what is in the best interest of the community as a whole. I've always kind of, as a law enforcement officer, and especially into my later years, probably within the last decade, I have really set my mind to believe in the 97% to 3% rule. And what I mean by that is 97% of the populations, and I don't care what population you're talking about, any type of people in any type of profession, are good people that sometimes make mistakes. 3% of the population are just wired wrong, and I think those are the population that, you know, law enforcement needs to deal with. So the key for me has been not to treat the 97% of the people as 3% of the people, to treat
Sergeant Rezga, thank you so much for joining us. That was Sergeant Tony Rezga, 16-year veteran of the Darlington Police Department.
It's been 3 years since water samples from ponds at Wisconsin frac sand mines showed high concentrations of heavy metals, up to 4 times higher than state standards. Now the State Department of Natural Resources is planning a study to see if metal from those ponds is leaching from mines and polluting groundwater. As Rich Kramer reports, 2 similar studies are already underway, aimed at better understanding what's in our water and the sand we mine.
On a ridge just outside the city of Arcadia, a team of geologists with the University of Wisconsin Extension stand around a truck-mounted drilling rig, slowly grinding into the sandstone beneath their feet. Team leader Jay Zambito says they're studying the minerals holding the state's prized frac sand together. They pull a 5-foot core of rock from the drill and lay it in special cardboard boxes. It's beautiful, with layers of green, red, tan, and orange. Zambito says this is where the Tunnel City and Waniwak sandstone formations meet and where their minerals and heavy metals are concentrated. Zambito says the minerals are what keep the metals locked inside the rock formations. His theory is that when miners break the rock up, the minerals might dissolve.
You might be exposing minerals that can easily break down, and those minerals, if they have trace metals present, and those trace metals get into the water, the surface water then becomes poor quality, and then it interacts with the groundwater. Groundwater then becomes of lesser quality.
When the Department of Natural Resources sampled water used by companies to wash frac sand in 2013, it didn't answer the question of whether metals from mines are contaminating water. They found aluminum concentrations 178 times higher than state standards, along with lead and manganese levels 4 times what the agency recommends for groundwater. But the water was cloudy with sediment, and researchers couldn't tell if those metals were in the sediment or the water itself. DNR frac sand specialist Roberta Walls says that's why they're moving forward with a comprehensive groundwater study next year, which could be finished in time for a review of sand mining water pollution permits.
Given the, you know, the way studies are formulated and analyzed, it's likely that the study would be prepared and ready to go for a review of the next permit issuance. But we do have the ability to make changes to the existing if necessary in between.
The next DNR review of industrial sand mining water permits is scheduled for 2021. But Midwest Environmental Advocates attorney Sarah Gears says residents living near frac sand mines are worried that metals could be getting into their well water now. High concentrations of metals have been shown to cause brain and nerve damage. She says that's why answers can't come soon enough.
For the citizens who rely on groundwater for drinking, for people who fish in the streams around these facilities, it's not good enough to say we're looking into it and we may tell you a few years down the road that indeed this facility has been polluting water for the past several years.
In a coffee shop in downtown Eau Claire, UW-Eau Claire geology professor Brian Mahoney says worries about heavy metals in groundwater may be overblown. For the past year, he and his students have been sampling rivers and municipal wells in western Wisconsin for heavy metals. So far, the levels are well below drinking water standards.
So it doesn't seem as if there's a lot of material coming off the rock getting into the groundwater. Some certainly, but not very much.
Mahoney wants to chemically test the rock itself to see if exposing it to air and weather could cause metals to bleed from exposed sandstone. But he says that kind of science is expensive, and he's looking for funding.
Ideally, it would be the DNR, could be the Wisconsin Geological Natural History Survey, could be the state legislator. So just to remove any appearance of industry influence on the project whatsoever.
This summer, the DNR began requiring some frac sand mines to test for trace metals in water they discharge into nearby streams. The Wisconsin Industrial Sand Association says that has cost operators tens of thousands of dollars, even though there's no proof what they do is causing metals to leach from the state's hillsides into our groundwater. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.